Hi, this is Lindsay Miller, and you are listening to the Arkansas Times Week Interview Podcast on Friday, August 2nd. On this week's episode, we're going to talk about Little Rock Mayor Frank Scott and the police, State Representative Mickey Gates' tax troubles, Jason Rapert's political future, and President Trump's pardon of Ted Sewell. I'm excited today to be joined by special guest Jay Barth.
Hey, AJ. Lindsay. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. So it's been a momentous couple weeks for Little Rock Mayor Frank Scott and the local law enforcement community. Of course, Scott campaigned on kind of a police reform agenda, and during the campaign was slandered by the Fraternal Order of Police, and so that was an issue we knew there was going to be some tension going in there. Scott had a big political win, I guess it was last week, getting the Citizens Review Board ordinance passed through. He was the deciding vote, city board. It's been kind of a different story in the last week or so as reporting has come out with the surrounding the Civil Service Commission hearing that happened last week. It was some real dramatic testimony. It was cut short, unfortunately, because Officer Charles Starks, who's subject to the hearing, who was fired after he killed Bradley Blackshire in February, his attorney, Robert Newcomb, fell down the stairs at the end of the hearing and broke his wrist, and so it's been delayed indefinitely. But some real dramatic testimony during that, including from two police assistant chiefs, who were both up for the chief position, who said that Scott put undue pressure on the department to fire Starks. And since that hearing, you've heard more from one of those chiefs, Hayward Finks, and also from Pulaski County Prosecutor Larry Jegley, mm-hmm. Both casting Scott in not a very good light.
Yeah, it's been a pretty brutal week, and I think the key point is that in many ways the mayor has been muted in responding this week because City Attorney Tom Carpenter issued a memo to all city officials saying, because this is an ongoing hearing that is not yet finished, they shouldn't speak because they could create bias in the process.
Right, and that was in reaction to City Director Ken Richardson giving an interview to KRK where he said that he didn't believe the assistant chief's testimony.
Exactly.
Later he sort of walked that back.
Right, but obviously the mayor is the one who has been the subject of most of the charges, and he did finally issue a press release that was very brief and basically said, I'm going to respect the city attorney's warning not to speak. But it's been very odd because, as you said, you know, the hearing kind of stopped midway and we don't even know when it's going to pick back up. And yet every day this week, there's been a pretty brutal front page article in the Democrat Gazette with charges of varying types from varying folks that you've already mentioned. It's very fascinating. I was thinking about it today because, you know, obviously we got the news from New York in terms of the firing of a policeman there who's involved in this very high profile situation 5 years ago. Then of course Mayor Pete Buttigieg has his continuing challenges in South Bend, which are high profile only because he's running for president. And so it's there's a lot of value in being mayor right now. I mean, it is a spot where you can do a lot of good for people and be creative and innovative, but it is also the place where stuff like this is almost inevitable to be front and center. Mayor Scott, I think we don't know exactly what the truth is in terms of who said what when. I do think what's very clear, and was very clear during the campaign, is that that Mayor Scott, because of the lived experience he's had and the community of which he is a part, I think, has an understanding of the frustration with the African-American community in Little Rock about abuses by the police over time, including the no-knock searches and a variety of other things. And I think he has a different worldview about this than other folks who have historically been in that role and who are probably more patient because they trust the process more than folks who come from the parts of town where Frank Mayor Scott grew up. And so I do think he's got kind of a very different worldview, and he is probably more impatient, and that's totally understandable. That said, this is a process. It's a very serious process, and all of these things related to both the analysis of whether somebody should lose their job or whether charges should be filed. You know, there is a process that has to be followed, and balancing those two things out, which I think are both legitimate, right? We need to be impatient about this stuff. That said, on the other hand, you know, we do have to abide by these processes. And so it's a challenging issue. It is part of being a mayor in a racially divided city in 2019.
Well, as you mentioned, and we talked about earlier, the hearing still has some time to go. I mean, I guess I'm not a student of civil service hearings to know how often they're upheld. I think most observers would think that if Starks does not get his job back through the civil service hearing, he's likely to get it through a circuit court appeal.
Right.
And some, at least, will blame Scott for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's very interesting. I was watching Mayor Buttigieg today, being asked by an African American voter about why things were being so slow in South Bend in that case, and you know he basically said I could not call for him to be fired because that would almost make it inevitable that he would successfully be able to sue and get his job back. So it's a really difficult thing because folks really want leadership from their mayor on these, and in particular individuals from communities that feel that they have been abused by the police over time really want leadership from the mayor in a very clear way, but that is something that almost inevitably mucks up the system in a way that, as you suggest, leads to the opposite outcome, the outcome that probably almost no one wants outside of, you know, the policeman and his family. So it's a yucky situation, and it is an early test for this mayor on, as you said, perhaps, you know, one of the issues with which he was most closely identified during his campaign.
Well, in the Citizens Review Board, from a political standpoint, I think that it's got to be considered a huge victory for
him. Huge win, a very close win, and, you know, it was an interesting coalition of the city board. It was the African-American members of the city board, but then the two white members who are arguably the most politically progressive members, Kathy Webb and Kathy Peck. You know, I think what was very interesting is that sometimes we do see division within police ranks between the Fraternal Order of Police, which is primarily white, and then the Black Police Officers Association. They were unified in saying we don't want this oversight. Let's allow the Civil Service Commission to continue to play that role. But there was this, you know, this coalition that came together. And what Mayor Scott needs moving forward, he needs that coalition to become much more of a permanent coalition if he is going to be able to govern in the way I think he wants. When you look at his agenda, the kinds of things he wants to get done, he's not consistently been able to put that coalition together. He did put it together on this really important vote. I think he worked very hard to get that vote, worked those votes very, very aggressively, and was able to to pull it off. You know, it does. If that vote had been a few days later, it might have been more complicated because of this hearing and its aftermath.
Well, yeah, that's the for a really ambitious mayor that is a potential stumbling block. You got to have five votes to do anything.
Yep. And it's also not. I don't think a mayor wants to be the tiebreaker all the time. I mean, that suggests a tension. That said, I think he'd be happy to do it if it got him win after win after win. It's going to be tricky to keep that coalition together. We saw, you know, on another issue which he cared deeply about, which was getting the entertainment district up and running in the River Market. You know, he did lose one of the African American voters, Irma Hendricks, who's decidedly conservative on a lot of issues. He did lose her on that, was able to pick up some other white.
I think she just explained her vote just because I'm a Christian.
Yes, that was her that was her. Anyway, it made more sense than some things that Ms. Hendricks has said over the years.
Yeah, well, there's nothing more exciting than city politics in Little Rock right now.
It's great. I mean, it's great because it matters. It feels like it matters, and I think for so long, you know, city government has been such a snoozer because it has felt so detached from people's lives. I do think that this mayor, no matter what challenges continue to exist, there is an energy around city government right now which we've not seen probably in our lifetime.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to state government. State Representative Mickey Gates last year was charged with six counts of felony. Failure to pay state income tax, I think, was the charge. He managed to get reelected despite those charges hanging over him. Many Republican officials, including the governor, the attorney general, lieutenant governor, called for Gates to resign. He soldiered through, I mean, won handily his reelection bid. I think he got 65% of the vote. He agreed to a plea deal this week. He pleaded no contest to charges, and in exchange, he gets 6 years of probation, has to pay taxes from 2012 to 2014, totaling about $75,000, and then has to file his tax return for the last 2 years and then presumably pay those. Mm-hmm. In the wake of this, Gates immediately said, well, you know, I'm going to have it. This is not the equivalent of a guilty plea. In fact, he said he was innocent today. He says he's going to keep on. He's not has no plans to resign. But today, the House Speaker, Matthew Shepard, said that he should resign. If he was in his place, he'd resign. And said that he's had some talks with members about removing him. Mm-hmm. And the governor said he should resign.
Yeah. Well, several things about this. I mean, first off, it's, you know, his continued innocent claims are just comical at this point. I mean, you know, this is the most clear case that one could imagine. That said, it is also, I was shocked that the plea deal did not include his departure from the legislature. When I first saw the headlines, I assumed that was going to be in the first paragraph. It wasn't there. And you know, many would say, okay, these charges they are not the kind of public corruption things that we've seen in some other cases. But when you are, you know, someone raising people's taxes and not paying taxes, it suggests some connection. I think it is inevitable that he's going to leave office. I think, you know, today's aggressive statements by the governor and the speaker pretty much doom him. I just don't see how he survives this. And at this point, he's gotten a pretty good deal, and he really should just take the deal and you know, gracefully or gracelessly, you know, go back to Garland County and his
custom knife business.
They are snazzy knives. I have seen them in person. They're very snazzy.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
So I could get an Arkansas Times engraved knife.
You could.
That's
fun. Yeah, yeah, you should work on that.
He won so handily that one would think that generic Republican candidate probably could win a special election if he resigned.
Yeah, it's a district that's it's a kind of almost totally white rural district. It's a Trump district, basically kind of between kind of out between Hot Springs, Benton, and Malvern. You know, in that land there, you probably can't get more Republican in 2019 than that kind of district. So I think it's going to be a Republican win. I mean, you know, Democrats, you know, probably had the best run they were going to have last time. Now I don't know I don't think there's a heir apparent, but I think it's probably pretty clear what's going to happen. I do think the case, you know, they need to get rid of it. The Republicans do need to get rid of him. Obviously, it's not been a pretty year for Republicans in state government in terms of folks who have had to resign or been convicted or pled guilty, and this obviously another in that list. Now, we don't know what's still coming down the pike. We don't know that there won't be some Democrats who also are felled by corruption charges. But it's, you know, if you know, you started the 2020 election now, I mean, state Democrats would have something to emphasize as a party, you know, that they are, you know, need to be elected to help clean up state government. This would help. His resignation would help kind of take one of those pieces off the table.
Let's talk about another piece of news that came out today. State Senator Jason Rapert says that he's running for lieutenant governor in 2022.
Yeah, this is interesting. He would be up for re-election. Obviously, he had a surprisingly tough re-election in 2018. He did not have a particularly well-funded opponent, but he won, I think, 55-45, suggesting that district is one, and it's most of Faulkner County. It's not all of Faulkner County, and then it's got a little divot out of Perry County where he lives. It's a district that has, in the Trump era, begun to become a little more Democratic, slightly more Democratic. So it's a tougher district than it was at one point for him. He obviously has made it tougher on himself because of how high profile he is with his with what some would say were at times antics, but you know, I think is a pretty consistent voting record on some of these social issues. So the question is, I think that if a candidate like him was running 10 years ago in a Republican primary, I think he would have a very good chance of winning. I think the problem for him now is that Republican primaries are a much larger pool of voters than they once were. And it includes some folks who I think are probably just kind of turned off by the kind of social issues that he emphasizes, that care about some other issues a little bit more. He's certainly got a high profile. He certainly has shown some very good fundraising ability in his previous election, so he's going to have some money. To be honest, probably for Democrats, it would be very good if he got the nomination. In fact, Sarah Huckabee Sanders' gubernatorial candidacy and Senator Rapert as a lieutenant governor would be probably a great
dream ticket
for the Democrats. Obviously, it would still be a favored ticket, and both those candidates would likely win, and it would be an interesting time in Arkansas politics.
Obviously, if you're running for lieutenant governor, which has no power, then you have grander political aspirations.
Yeah. And I think some people thought that he might run for the second district. In fact, when that seat came open, when Tim Griffin gave it up, you know, he was mentioned for a couple of days and then bowed out of that race. And I think he's actually maybe in some ways better positioned for a second district race because he's got a base of support in Faulkner County, which is a big county. That's super interesting. And, you know, man, I don't think we've ever seen a campaign cycle begin as early as 2022. I mean, we're we're 3 years out, in essence. It's 2.5, I guess. It's going to be a wacky ride.
Well, let's go hyper-local and talk about your district. That's District 36. Mm-hmm. There's a special election going on right now. Mm-hmm. It's the Democratic primary, but I don't think there's been a Republican candidate in that district in, I don't know, modern times.
Yeah.
So the winner of the primary will almost certainly be the mm-hmm. candidate. So mm-hmm. you've got five candidates. Do you have anybody you think is the front runner?
You know, it's interesting. It's a difficult race to call. One reason being that the turnout has been almost non-existent. I think as of yesterday, they'd had cast about 164 votes. So it's probably going to be a very, very close race. I think it's almost inevitable there'll be a runoff, which would take place, I think, the Tuesday after Labor Day. Denise Innett is kind of a political activist who's been involved on a lot of different issues, both local and state. She's been the leading fundraiser. She has a fair amount of support from Progressive Arkansas Women PAC, which has put a lot of energy into recruiting more women to run for office. She's been active in Moms Demand action and a lot of education circles. So I think she has clearly a strong base of support. Philip Hood has, who was a labor appointee to the Workers' Compensation Commission, then is now a staff member at Workers' Comp. He has a lot of labor support and some kind of African-American establishment support in the race. I think they are probably the two best positioned. Daryl Stevens, a third candidate, ran against Charles Blake, has run a couple of times just run once for the legislature, talked about it another time. He ran against Blake 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, got about 36%, 37%, somewhere like that. So he's got a little bit of name recognition from that. And then there are two younger candidates, one of whom is a very interesting candidate because he was a victim of one of the no-knock searches. And then a student at Flanders Smith, Russell Williams, who I saw the forum on Monday night at South on Main. I think a lot of people were very impressed with Russell Williams. He performed very well. He's a smart, interesting guy, but doesn't have the kind of depth of ties in the district. He's from out of state. So, if you had to put money, you probably put it on Innett and Hood, but it's such a weird, minuscule electorate that really anything could happen, and almost inevitably there'll be a runoff.
How many people live in that district, do you know?
It's like any other. I mean, it's the same size as all the other districts. It is about 70% African-American district, so it's a majority-minority district, and is a very interesting district because it's got the kind of Quapaw Soma area conjoined with all the way down to Wrightsville and College Station. So it's got some of the literally some of the poorest, I think most disempowered portions of the county, and then some more affluent and pretty engaged parts of the county. So it's an interesting, weird district that has gotten weirder as changes have occurred in the Soma area in recent years.
I'm betraying my civics ignorance. This is why we need better civics education.
It's all about civics education.
I don't know that every district has the same amount of people.
Yeah. You just divide by 100.
Okay. That makes perfect sense.
Now, turnout does differ a lot.
Sure.
And now that we are at the end of a decade, it actually is a district that probably is a little bit smaller than other districts because they're areas of Northwest Arkansas that now have a lot of population that they didn't have at the start of the decade.
Ah, okay.
Sorry.
All right, well, let's, I guess we should mention, because we talked about it at the beginning, just quickly, that President Trump commuted the prison sentence of Ted Sewell, the former operator of behavioral health companies in Arkansas. He was convicted on bribery and fraud charges in July of 2016. The White House acknowledged in the release that this was because of the lobbying of former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee and former U.S. Attorney Bud Cummins. Sewell ran the Lord's Ranch, which was later renamed Trinity Behavioral Health. And we've written about Sewell a lot over the years, and I would encourage folks to go back and read some of that.
That's what I would say. It's complicated, and nobody's covered it the way the Arkansas Times has covered it over the years. But it was all part of a DHS kickback case, it's quite interesting that the president's continued use of the pardon and commutation power, in some pretty high-profile cases. This obviously, a case that has profile in Arkansas. It does not have profile nationally. A few people have. It has gotten some national resonance because of some issues related to the Lord's Ranch over time, some of the disciplinary measures and some things like that about that institution. But I think that's the more important piece to me is, as we think about some of the other folks in Trump land who have been convicted of violations of federal law, he certainly is a president who has a great willingness to use that power, which is pretty absolute, for folks that either he sees as friends or his friends see as friends, as we see in this case.
Okay, well, let's leave it there and move on to endorsements. Mm-hmm. I see you've got something ready to go.
I do like that shirt, so I will endorse.
If only this was a video podcast.
I'll endorse Lindsay's shirt. A book endorsement, Furious Hours, which is Casey Sepp, and she's you've seen her byline mostly in the New Yorker over the years, a very good writer. So this is that nonfiction book that's it's a weird conglomeration of Harper Lee, whose name is biggest on the title page, but this odd set of murder cases in Alabama. And then Harper Lee then goes down. First, there's an attorney who's kind of a central figure in helping get an African-American defendant off in some cases, but then ends up being on the other side at the end of the day. A lawyer that, has some parallels to Harper Lee's own father, who, of course, was the model for Atticus Finch. And Harper Lee, as I think most folks know, after To Kill a Mockingbird's completion, she ended up not writing much more, and the second book never came out. But she did work with Truman Capote on In Cold Blood, which is obviously classic work, and had become a real lover of true crime, and decides a true crime novel with this lawyer who feels a little bit like Atticus Finch might be the way to go, and wrote, but never published this book. And so Harper Lee doesn't appear in this book until about, a little over halfway in, but then it becomes very much a Harper Lee story. So anyway, it's a good read if you like. It touches a lot of things, whether you're a literary person and a student of American literature, or you're into race in the South. I mean, and it's got this fascinating history of life insurance, which is actually super interesting. So that was actually what I was most interested by. So I recommend that.
I haven't read it. It's on my list of books to read soon. But there's a fascinating interview with Sepp on the Long Form podcast,
Cool.
Where they interview writers.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things they talked about, is how the guy was like, I was so fascinated by the life insurance part. Yeah. But she has a really interesting background. I think she went to divinity school. And she has written for The New Yorker quite a bit, but mostly online. I mean, this book was her first big thing, really. So she's getting
tons. She's very young.
Tons of acclaim kind of right out of the gate. I'm going to endorse, I think I maybe endorsed a song from this early on. Who can remember? But the new album by Purple Mountains. I actually forget what it's called. It may be just called Purple Mountains, but it's the new band that David Berman, famous or barely famous for Silver Jews, as Silver Jews was a band that, I guess, from the mid 90s to the early aughts was really popular in small circles for kind of super literate indie rock. He had a line, "All my favorite singers couldn't sing," and that sort of applies to him. He doesn't have a very pretty voice, but he's just an incredibly smart lyricist and compelling and fun and funny. He did a lot of collaborating with Stephen Malkmus, who was in the band some, and recorded several albums. But this is his first music in, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. He quit because he just got tired, but also he put this kind of cryptic note about how he's quitting because his music wasn't doing anything to right the wrongs of his father. And it turns out that his father is, I forget what his first name is. His last name is Berman, and maybe also David Berman. It is like one of the worst corporate lobbyists in the world. Like, has done every awful anti-labor, anti-consumer protection thing. And so Berman outed him on this and just kind of hid away. But he's back with a new album, and it's great. Check it out.
On the music front, since I don't get to endorse all the time.
Yeah.
Something I mentioned to you, National Park Radio is this kind of funky band that has some Arkansas ties. The lead singer is from Boone County. I think maybe one other person in the band, but their songs, there's a lot of analogies tied to natural beauty and mountains and such like that. Anyway, it's very interesting music. It may annoy you, but I find it addictive. So, yeah. And they've been playing this state and national park tour this summer. I got turned on to them because we were floating the Kings River, and they were getting ready to have a concert there at the Kings River in outside Eureka Springs earlier in the late spring. And I started listening, and they're really interesting stuff. So. To check it out as well.
Wow. If I was in a band doing a national park tour, I mean, if you could make money, actually.
It would be pretty awesome.
That'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, they played the Buffalo not long ago and apparently had a really nice show there.
Wow. All right. Well, thanks for being here, Jay.
Thank you.
And we will be back soon. Maybe even next week. We'll see. Thanks.